Eco-modernism puts modernization at the center of its ism. And it, you know, it says, you know, the world and increasingly nature and even the earth system are kind of, as we say in the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, increasingly made by human hands. We have unprecedented power to shape our environments, to live in all sorts of different environments. And, you know, the sort of things that will determine our future are not sort of biophysical, fundamental biophysical limits to what kind of species we can be. They're human choices and decisions that we make, the worlds that we decide to build.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Bunga Cast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hokuli in São Paulo, Brazil, as usual. And today, joined by regular contributor Lee Phillips, who's producing this episode, and delighted to welcome Ted Nordhaus, who I will introduce in just a second. Hi, Ted.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to be speaking with you today. Let me just do a brief introduction. Ted is a co-founder and executive director of the Breakthrough Institute, which is a California-based eco-modernist think tank, which is, I think, notorious in certain quarters of the environmental movement for what one might call industrial-scale slaughtering of sacred cows. These are ideas such as environmentalism's small is beautiful bias, or its back-to-the-land mindset, a certain technophobia that might be there, in particular in its opposition to nuclear power, to genetic engineering and industrial agriculture. And in maybe broad brush terms, it's anti-modernism, it's Malthusianism and anti-humanism, which I think, as we've discussed on this podcast a number of times, I think is something that gets expressed through environmentalism very often. Over the last decade, the school of thought that calls itself eco-modernism has spread beyond its base in the San Francisco Bay Area to Europe, Canada, Australia, sub-Saharan Africa, and the Indian subcontinent. And it now takes various different forms beyond its research and analysis origins, from the protest and activism of groups like We Planet to the education and awareness raising of groups like Mothers for Nuclear, the Good Energy Collective, Generation Atomic, to more formal tendencies within mainstream parties like the Finnish Green Party, the lobbying work of Canadians for Nuclear Power, and Breakthrough's own recently established Washington, D.C. branch. Now, as maybe listeners are aware, eco-modernism and the Breakthrough Institute in particular have been the object of severe opprobrium within that same environmental community for the iconoclasm I already made reference to, and it seems repeated legislative and technological success stories. So, for example, anti-nuclear and anti-GMO campaigners denounce you, Ted, and the Breakthrough Institute, by extension, as shills of the nuclear industry and of Big Ag. Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil radicals on the climate left denounce eco-modernism as capitalist ideology, effectively. And the very largest of the multimillionaire, multimillion-dollar environmental mega NGOs like Greenpeace and the National Resources Defense Council worry that eco-modernism is winning not just in the halls of power, but amongst voters who don't even know the term, which is a kind of a funny situation to be in. And just before I bring you in, Ted, I just want to make reference to the recent episode, which came out, I think, last week, for when listeners are hearing this, talking about climate disinformation and why that is a misguided sort of approach. So I've said eco-modernism a couple of times, and listeners may be familiar with the term, but for others, not so much. So what actually is it?
Well, thanks. Great to be here, and that's a great introduction. So eco-modernism, you know, really, I'd like to think is at this point something close to a sort of fully blown alternative sort of vision or ism for people who kind of care about the environment, but are not so sure they're ready to sign up for a lot of the baggage that environmentalism brings along for the ride, like the sort of Malthusianism that you mentioned, the kind of romanticism for this sort of agrarian past, you know, the kind of the, you know, this sort of the all the ways in which it's this very sort of elite sort of exercise in sort of pulling up the ladder in some ways, you know, undertaken by kind of the most privileged, richest, most consumptive people in the world, who now insist that the planet won't tolerate everybody else sort of living the kind of remarkable modern lives that all of us involved in these debates actually live by any sort of global or historical standard. So, you know, eco-modernism basically says, you know, we haven't fallen from nature, we've risen.
Right.
That there's no nature without humans, that the sort of planet that we live on today is sort of vastly more habitable for kind of human civilization and for human societies than the one we started with, which might have been able to support a few million people. Today, we live on a planet that supports 8 billion. And that's 8 billion people, frankly, almost all of whom live kind of with far higher living standards, even the global poor, than sort of most people did. The vast majority of the population certainly did even just 200 years ago. So, and, you know, I think the key difference between eco-modernism and environmentalism, you know, for me, it's just a question of what do you put at the center of your ism? Environmentalism puts this idea of the environment at the center of its ism and basically says, there's this thing called the environment that contains us, that defines and limits human possibility. And if you exceed those limits, and they call it now planetary boundaries, so everything falls apart and us along with it. Mm. And eco-modernism puts modernization at the center of its ism. And it, you know, it says, you know, the world and increasingly nature and even the Earth system are kind of, as we say in the eco-modernist manifesto, increasingly made by human hands. We have unprecedented power to shape our environments, to live in all sorts of different environments. And, you know, this sort of things that will determine our future are not sort of biophysical, fundamental biophysical limits to what kind of species we can be. They're human choices and decisions that we make, the worlds that we decide to build. And I think at bottom, it's a difference between, you know, because of what's at the center of the ism, environmentalism says we live in a closed system. And a closed system means a closed future. And eco-modernism says, no, we live in a very open system, including the, you know, like the planet we live on, you know, was sort of formed from the dust of, you know, exploding stars and was bombarded by asteroids. So it's never been a closed system, and it's still not a closed system. It's open. And if, you know, when we live in an open system, that means we have an open future. It doesn't mean that future will necessarily be good or bad for that matter. It means that, you know, we kind of get to decide, and we are not going to all sit down and have a big convention and decide it. That's not how we, you know, there's no really kind of we here exactly making these decisions. Mm-hmm. We're in the midst of a very long-term sort of emergent process of sort of shaping the future of the human species and the planet, and what kinds of natures are going to kind of come along for the ride, you know, continue along on this ride with us. And So for me, that's the critical difference before we get into, well, why do we like nuclear energy, or why do we like genetically modified foods or industrial agriculture or cities? Or what do we think about, you know, capitalism versus not capitalism? Like for me, the sort of central insight and claims in eco-modernism are prior to all of that.
Right. So one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on at the moment, Ted, is that this year is the 20th anniversary of the publication of The Death of Environmentalism, which you co-wrote with Michael Schellenberger, which is a sort of prologue to what would become eco-modernism. That 16,000 word essay, and I think it was published in Grist. Is that right?
No, we self-published it.
Oh, you self-published it. Okay.
And then Grist republished it, and it sort of existed, but it really launches itself by kind of deciding that it was going to actually host this big debate within the environmental community. It's a real contrast to sort of the ways in which there's so much effort to sort of shut down a lot of these discussions now. To their credit, they said, we're going to sort of, you know, teach the controversy. We're going to kind of embrace it because it, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the thesis that we put out at that time, it's an important conversation to have.
Yeah, that's you're absolutely right that there does seem to be a closing of the discourse here. Maybe we can get to that in a minute or two. But 2024 is also the 10th anniversary of the Eco-Modernist Manifesto. I think it's 2014 that came out, which ultimately extend the argument even further after that initial essay put the cat amongst the pigeons. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your early background in the environmental movement and what happened in your life and work that prompted the writing of that seminal essay, and then what happened in the decade after that that demanded the publication of that, you know, sort of most factionally political of documents, a manifesto, and then the founding of your think tank. How did that all come together?
Yeah. So I spent my early career in the environmental movement, and I was not a researcher or a writer or a public intellectual or a policy wonk or any of that. I was just doing, you know, metal and tong grassroots organizing when I started, like literally like knocking on doors, in the mid late 1980s, talking to people about environmental issues and trying to kind of, you know, mobilize sort of political action. And I did kind of almost everything you could do in the environmental movement, except kind of like writing essays and doing sort of policy development. I ran campaigns. I was a pollster for a while. And almost always, vast majority of my work was involved in kind of in and around the environmental movement, mostly accepting the kind of foundational claims of the movement. In right after 9/11, with some other folks, I sort of started working on this. And it was already clear that the kind of basic idea about how, you know, we were going to make progress on climate change was wrong, you know, that there was going to be these sort of global caps and we were going to kind of put a price on carbon and sort of either tax it or have a cap and trade system. And really, we were going to kind of treat this problem like we had treated past pollution problems like air, you know, air pollution or water pollution. And, you know, this is in the sort of early days of the first George W. Bush term. He's pulled out of the Kyoto Accords. We've invaded Iraq. We're after 9/11 and everyone's freaked out about national security. So we're like, well, maybe we should sort of reset this climate argument less around sort of, you know, catastrophe, environmental catastrophe, and sort of talking about this as a pollution problem and just talk about it as an energy problem. And I think there was a lot of thought at that time that the way you solved this, and, you know, the way you would do that was around national security concerns in the U.S. that, you know, we were kind of giving all our money to the Saudis who were underwriting all the terrorists who were trying to blow us up and all of that kind of thing. And I was still a pollster at the time. And so I did like literally, you know, if you kind of go and you trace like the Green New Deal and the Inflation Reduction Act and all of that thinking all the way back to its origins, well, its origins are really in this thing that we called the Apollo Project back in like 2001, 2002 when we're launching it. And I'm a pollster. So I start doing the polling on this and literally like the first, we were like, let's go talk to, we used to call them Reagan Democrats. They were white, working class, you know, kind of Midwest industrial flyover state kind of types who, you know, were still at that time, you know, literally registered as Democrats and considered themselves Democrats, but then would go vote for guys like Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. So we're like, well, let's go talk to these guys about this problem. And so we go to Erie, Pennsylvania, and we have these non-college educated like white guys in the room. And we're like, all right, let's talk about this idea of like, let's get off of oil and let's invest in these new technologies. And this is how we'll beat the terrorists. And, you know, the thing that becomes immediately clear is they don't really care so much about the terrorists. What they're really interested in is like whether like all of this effort around kind of getting off of oil might result in opening some new factories in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things I did back when I was a pollster and I would run focus groups, I would kind of do the focus group and we'd get most of the way through it. And then I would actually excuse myself. I would walk out of the room and I would go to the back behind the, you know, one-way glass and, you know, I would just sort of say that I was going to go consult with my colleagues, see if they had any other questions, which I always did. But the most valuable thing was to kind of just not be in the room and stand behind that mirror with no one kind of overseeing the conversation and see what people talked about. And what these guys all started talking about was just speculating about what company we were that might be coming to build like a wind turbine factory in Erie. So that was kind of like this aha moment. Like we kind of found the kind of whatever the skeleton key that sort of really could change how the politics around climate worked. And if you go through all of the green jobs and the sort of Obama stimulus and green stimulus investments and really all the way up through, like that's really the origin of kind of all of it. So then we have this great idea and we've got great polling. You know, we kind of do some polling that shows that it's not just these like 10 guys in a room in Erie, Pennsylvania, that this stuff polls really well, especially with like swing constituencies that, you know, I was much more of a dyed-in-the-wool progressive Democrat at the time than I am now. But, you know, so we're like, this works. This is a win, right? And we go and we like literally the first like kind of major kind of name brand constituency we get on board is the United Steelworkers, who are like, oh, this is interesting. And they go and do their own polling. And they're like, we don't, but we're not sure we believe you. So we're going to have our pollster poll this again. And their pollster gets exactly the same results. So they're like, we're in. So now we got the steelworkers. We got great polling. We're like, this is how we really kind of make progress on climate change. And we take it around to all the big green groups and the leadership and the people doing all the climate work. Just no interest. They're like, you know, literally the famous line from what becomes the death of environmentalism, because we then went and interviewed a bunch of these guys, is the head of the Sierra Club's like whole like federal climate policy advocacy program is like, not our job to do industrial policy. I mean, so funny to hear that now, right? Where like mm-hmm. it's the coin of the realm. So after a while of just getting totally fed up with it, we write this essay called The Death of Environmentalism, which we self-publish. We throw up on this crappy little website we had. That the Breakthrough Institute didn't exist at that time. We just had a website. And I and Michael Schellenberger, who I worked with at the time, had both been invited to speak at this big annual meeting of the Environmental Grant Makers Association. And so we like take this essay out. And this essay basically is like, environmentalism just has got to change. Like, we're not going to solve the climate problem in the same way we solved the air pollution problem. We're not going to solve this as a pollution problem. It's a technology and infrastructure and industrial policy problem. And this is the way forward. And we go to the environmental grant makers and we literally self-publish. We like, in addition to the website, and this is long before social media or anything, and we self-publish this thing. We put it on our website and we bring like literally like 500 copies, like pamphlets of this thing printed out to this meeting. We just put them out on the tables. So within like 24 hours, the Green Group, which is the big coordinating thing of all the big environmental NGOs in Washington, has literally like flown out a rapid response team to kind of rebut us at this meeting of philanthropists.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was crazy. And the whole thing went kind of nuts. And it went, the thing went viral. People are reading it all over the world. They're arguing about it. Grist is like, we're going to host the conversation. The head of the Sierra Club is like literally flaming us publicly. And yeah, it was like a really kind of big deal in its moment. It was one of the first kind of things like this that really goes viral. And people understood what it meant for something like this to kind of go viral, you know, on the internet.
And how did it lead into the Eco-Modernist Manifesto? What?
So now we have this critique, right? We got this great critique, but it's still really mostly a political critique. You know, we still are like, the future is just like renewable energy. You know, we're going to run the whole world on the wind and the sun. And we just need to do it with like industrial policy and public investment and a much stronger sort of state-led approach than what the environmental movement has historically advocated. And we're also even early on kind of pushing back against this sort of catastrophic framings of climate change, that even then, that's the amazing thing, even then, this is 20 years ago, there's tons of evidence already that it doesn't work, that this is not how you actually kind of mobilize action, that it actually gets people to be fatalistic, that it's super polarizing. So, but, you know, we start kind of, then people are like, well, what should we do? And we're kind of like, well, go spend a lot of money. And it's like, well, how do you spend the money? So, you know, long story short, we end up sort of starting Breakthrough as kind of a research think tank. And we're writing a book based on the essay called, the book was ultimately called Breakthrough, that came out in 2007. And, you know, we're kind of a little bit like the dog that caught the car, right? We're like, everyone wants to know, okay, so what do we do? And we're like, well, we don't really know. We need to go figure it out. So we spend a bunch of years just like actually kind of, you know, it's a little embarrassing in some ways that we're like, we kind of have the solution, except we still are like kind of pretty clueless about like how like energy systems work and the role that energy really plays in modern economies. So we spend a bunch of years like finally like figuring out that like, you know, you need lots and lots more energy, you know, if everyone on the planet is going to live something that looks like a modern life. And you need a lot of clean energy if you're going to do that and not, you know, kind of continue to warm the planet multiple degrees. And once you start figuring out like, well, how do you do that? You know, it gets clear that you're not going to remotely do all of that solely with like intermittent sources of renewable energy. And so we ultimately come to kind of realizing that nuclear is this kind of remarkable technology that we already, you know, kind of has already kind of done this to varying degrees in various places around the world. We start digging into agriculture and conservation, because we're sort of really, the aspiration here is a sort of bigger reset of environmentalism. It's not just a kind of what's the strategy for climate change. And, you know, kind of the more we learn about that, the more we realize that really for all the talk of climate change, like global agriculture remains the single largest human impact on the environment, on biodiversity, on the ecosystems. And, you know, like, you know, being good, like a good Berkeley liberal, I'm like, I love my, you know, farmer's market, organic, super whatever. But the more I like dig into the literature on agriculture, I'm like, this would be a disaster for the planet. You know, certainly
because of the land footprint and so on.
Yeah. Mostly because it's just the land use.
Yeah.
So, you know, 10 years later, we kind of finally have enough clarity to go kind of pull a bunch of other folks who are sort of fellow travelers in various areas and write this thing called the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, which, you know, sort of basically says that, you know, most of the things that the environmental movement tells you are good for the environment are actually bad for the environment. And a lot of the things they tell you are bad for the environment are actually good for the environment, just to kind of put a fine point on it. And you know, if you want like, you know, a future in which, you know, 8-9 billion people live, you know, kind of modern lives, you get everybody out of poverty, people, you know, kind of can sort of have the ability to sort of make their own decisions about sort of what sorts of work and what sort of lives they want to live, you know, you're going to kind of do that with, you know, large, it's not small as beautiful, it's big as beautiful. You need big, large scale technological systems, infrastructure, you need dense energy, you need intensive agriculture. And, you know, a lot of those people, most of those city people are going to live in cities. And a bunch of that stuff is kind of already happening. And so it's really a question of, you know, how much, to what degree and how quickly you can accelerate it so that by the time you get to this place where it's like, there's 8 billion people and, you know, population is stable and everyone's reasonably kind of has their material needs met, you haven't like destroyed all your rainforests and emptied out the oceans and warmed the planet 3 or 4 degrees.
So when you're confronted with some of the accusations from traditional environmentalists and the climate left, one of the things that is regularly said is that, you know, the Breakthrough Institute and eco-modernism more broadly is an apologist for capitalism. But what's interesting about what you just said there was very early on, you were quite critical of these sort of typically solely market-based approaches for tackling climate change, such as carbon taxes or cap and trade at a global level. And, you know, leaning more into industrial policy, 20 years later, what, you know, you are the dog that caught the car. The Inflation Reduction Act is exactly that. Interestingly, it isn't very well received in some quarters of the environmental, particularly the climate left. Do you consider the industrial policy of the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and so on and so forth, to be more in line with the eco-modern approach? But you've been quite... So now that you've caught the car in recent weeks or months, you've actually come out with some interesting analysis and research saying it's in the absence of some significant changes like, you know, permitting reform and a few other things, even the tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars being spent won't actually move the needle terribly much with respect to a reduction of emissions. Could you explain your love-hate relationship with the Inflation Reduction Act?
That's really well put, Lee. And, you know, I think, you know, on one level, like having kind of given birth to this kind of, you know, we published this essay many years ago from Bruno Latour that's still a kind of the very, you know, the famous sort of French philosopher, anthropologist who passed away recently. But it's still kind of like a really important idea for me. It was called Love Your Monsters. So I feel like my relationship to the Inflation Reduction Act and the various sort of implementation issues is really about kind of sort of loving a monster that I played a significant role in creating and not abandoning it. That was, you know, he's talking about Frankenstein and he says Dr. Frankenstein's sort of sin was not in creating the monster, but in abandoning it, fleeing, running away from it, not loving it. And so kind of like, what does it mean to kind of love the Inflation Reduction Act and to love this sort of new paradigm that we help to kind of give birth to? And for me, I think it's, you know, it sort of starts with, you know, I want it to succeed, and succeeding means like, you know, sort of one, having sort of realistic expectations about what industrial policy and frankly policy can do, particularly in a democracy where you don't get to just sort of tell everyone that tomorrow everyone buys an electric car. And, you know, it's like, well, they can go along with that, or they can, like, you know, throw you out of office, or, you know, as in France, you know, throw a riot. You know, there are some real kind of democratic and political constraints on these agendas, even when they're well conceived. And often I think there's a kind of, you know, I think this is where I've probably become, you know, a bit more libertarian in my old age. You know, I kind of want, I still very much believe in like industrial planning and public investment in technology and infrastructure. I think it's really, really important. And I want planning and industrial policy that kind of takes Hayek and Buchanan seriously. Hayek in like actually taking the knowledge problem seriously and recognizing that sort of there are just real limits to what kind of central planners can actually understand, and that the pathways are always emergent. They're always partial. They're always, it's not going to work the way you think it's going to work. And sort of building strategies that are kind of robust to those uncertainties rather than kind of imagining that through sort of sheer analytical and technocratic competence, you can eliminate the uncertainties. And then, you know, Buchanan famously is the public choice problem, you know, and the ways in which, you know, public institutions get kind of captured by interests, whose interests are, you know, that there are sort of, you know, principal agent problems between sort of public and the expression of the public's interests through public institutions, and the agents in the institutions sort of responding to various political actors who have their own interests, which are not necessarily aligned with the public's. So I kind of like, that's what I, you know, when I kind of go like, where, what should we be doing on a problem like climate change from the perspective, you know, I want lots of public investment. I want lots of infrastructure and industrial policy. And I want that to not become so captured by a kind of technocratic expert elite class that is, you know, always already sort of protective of its sort of privileges in this, you know, that it really goes off the rails. And we can point to a bunch of things already in the IRA implementation that have gone off the rails, I think, for these reasons. And then the second thing that you bring up, I mean, if you went back 20 years ago, we're saying climate change is not a regulatory problem to be, so, you know, it's not a problem that's going to be solved centrally by with regulation. It's going to be solved through public investment in technology and infrastructure. And we kind of win that argument. But now I think we're at a place where, you know, it kind of goes even beyond that, where it's like, okay, we've got huge investment in the technology and the infrastructure. But the problem now is not a lack of regulation. It's now a deregulatory challenge. We have to kind of clear a bunch of the, whether it's at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the National Environmental Policy Act in the US, or whatever, we got to clear up, you know, the past generation's environmental policies out of the way so that we can kind of go build this entirely new clean energy infrastructure at scale and do it reasonably quickly if anyone's serious about kind of, I mean, I don't believe we're going to be doing net zero in 2050, but to get anywhere close to that, it's a deregulatory problem at this point. The money, the public investment, the money is there, but it's so difficult to deploy technology, to deploy infrastructure, and to innovate at scale.
I mean, that hearing you say that, that seems to strike at the philosophical heart of what your proposal is in terms of seeing the approach to environmental questions as a matter of building out, a matter of doing more things rather than restraint. And for me, I mean, I've been a skeptic of environmentalism probably for like 20 years. And it always struck me as something like, as someone who identifies as a modernist and hopes that humanity can seize its own potential, that environmentalism's main contribution was to cultivate a kind of culture of restraint, of kind of holding back, of precaution, et cetera, et cetera. And that seems to be very clear. And I think it's interesting also to tie that to an understanding of democracy or the way in which society has been, I guess, de-democratized, or, you know, what some people talk of as post-democracy or the triumph of broken promises. Effectively, that the whole neoliberal era is a story of no longer promising people things, right? Of telling them, no, you're going to have to deal with less, and making people fight over having less effectively. And it seems that what you're proposing is also a vision which might promise more to people, not just promise less or trying to inculcate a sense of restraint.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you know, you go all the way back to the death of environmentalism. When we kind of contrast what we call the politics of limits with the politics of possibility. And, you know, you have to understand environmentalism, as you say, it's fundamentally and always has been just at its core a restrictive enterprise. We need to sort of restrict the human endeavor. We need to kind of, you know, it's like you go back to just the original, like we're going to protect wilderness areas and natural parks. We're going to draw a line around this thing called nature and say no humans in there. And that means you're also drawing them, you know, you're obviously drawing a line around the human enterprise. And, you know,
suggests we aren't natural. We aren't part of nature.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what we've been saying all along, and I think it gets ever more clear, is that, you know, you take a problem like climate change, it is fundamentally not a restrictive challenge. It is a generative challenge. You want to solve climate change, you literally have to go build an entire new energy economy that doesn't emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Full stop. There's not like climate change doesn't stop unless you do that. So if you want to stop climate change, that is what the, you know, fundamental enterprise is. And you can talk all you want about degrowth and, well, it'll be easier to do it if we kind of shrink the, you know, human consumption. This is what the kind of degrowth folks say. And it's like, there's the scale of the generative challenge is enormous, no matter how much you think you're going to go restrict human consumption. You know, if you just said no more growth today, you know, no more growth today, you're still at today's level of emission, and we're going to have it perfectly redistributed, you know, whatever it is, 5,000 per capita GDP globally. So we're going to take everyone in the global north, all you rich people, you're down to $5,000 a year, and we're going to bring everybody else up to $5,000 a year, which basically means that everyone on the planet is pretty damn poor. And still, you have to still go rebuild this massive energy infrastructure globally to actually deal with climate change.
And that seems to tie into what you said earlier. I mean, just a brief comment here that, you know, even if there was a rationalization of production that were possible to remove whole areas of the economy, which we think are somehow redundant or not useful for human life or, you know, suitable to human need, it's mainly just about value production and profit. So you can cut those things out. That still presumes an image and a model of what society is like, where there's just like this committee that gets together and is able to make decisions, right? That there's a kind of consensus and that there's a very hugely centralized ability to manage society. And it's interesting that you kind of started off by kind of critiquing that notion.
Always. I mean, you know, you go look at the planetary boundaries folks are literally like, we have to have a big committee of scientists who are just going to kind of decide sort of, who are going to manage the global carbon budget. I mean, I can't imagine that might go poorly. You know, even I don't know if you've had Nils, you know, my friend Nils Gilman, who I love and respect, but like he's got his new book out where I'll give a little plug for it. It's called Children of a Modest Star. And it's like, this is the guy who's been telling us for decades now that like, you know, the elites are the problem, that the elite, you know, kind of, we need better elites. And now, like, we're supposed to, like, basically kind of have these teams of scientists in charge of these planetary challenges. And, you know, I don't think one could, like, look at very much that's happened in the last even 4 or 5 years and be like, I think, like, kind of given a choice, like a, you know, the sort of global democratic electorate, is going to be very interested in kind of putting a bunch of technocrats and scientists in charge of their day-to-day lives. Would they?
Yeah, it sounds like just as, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, a number of countries moved monetary policy out of the hands of elected representatives and put them in central banks that are not very democratically accountable. And the European Union has increasingly made fiscal policy, removed it from directly democratically accountable sort of processes, with some considerable pushback amongst the populace in Europe, including one country that left the European Union over some of these questions. I cannot imagine that to remove wholesale questions around energy, industry, agriculture, and the rest of the Syrian Environmental Project remove that from democratic contestation ever being successful politically. Back to this question of sort of libertarianism and markets and industrial policy, and the Australian political scientist Jonathan Simons, you know, he wrote a book about eco-modernism sort of from the outside, but sort of from the inside. He has some levels of sympathy, but he's also trying to look at you sociologically. And he, you know, he makes the point sometimes that if eco-modernism as a school of thought had emerged anywhere else than the United States, if it had emerged in Europe or Canada or Australia, places where there is a very strong social democratic tradition, your critiques of market-based approaches like cap and trade and carbon taxes, emphasis on much more interventionist approaches like industrial policy, and of course what you just said in terms of your origin story with, you know, speaking to blue-collar workers and getting the steel workers to sign on, that this does seem fairly traditional social democratic stuff. Meanwhile, as eco-modernism has now expanded well beyond its San Francisco Bay Area sort of origins to groups like We Planet, organized by people like Mark Linus in the UK, but right across Europe, there is something of a different political flavor there to its American parent. Mark Linus in particular seems to want to knit back together some of the eco-modernist ideas with conventional environmentalism. You know, and they're very keen on street protest and civil disobedience. You know, recently there was a, I think, just fantastic little bit of civil disobedience by a German eco-modernist. And he took a page out of the conventional environmentalist playbook and climbed a nuclear cooling tower that Germany was going to, and ultimately did, destroy. How do you feel about these differences and these babies that you've, you know, that these little birds that have fled the nest?
Yeah, I mean, I really think, you know, I mean, on one level, I have a view that is kind of like, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, right? And some of those flowers are going to be more socialist or social democratic than others. And I think that's okay. You know, I mean, I there's this thing about where do we stand on the role of the state? And I can only speak for myself on that, you know, and my personal view is that I think in the discourse, there's a lot of kind of sort of reductive, like it's sort of like we're having this debate between like a bunch of libertarians who want a night watchman state and then like, you know, Vladimir Lenin. And that's not actually the debate. The debate is, you know, I just think, you know, the reality is that we're all living in a mixed economy, and there are a variety of sort of arguments about, you know, what's the right mix, how much state versus how much market, you know, what is reasonable to expect those things to do. And that's going to kind of look different in Northern Europe than it's going to look in the United States than it's going to look in Sao Paulo. And, you know, I'm a little bit like, I'm kind of like, I think that there's sort of pathways to sort of eco-modernish futures through any number of those kind of mixes. Some that'll be sort of more market, like, you know, I just think in the United States, just because of our, you know, we're not going to do Scandinavia or even Canada. And it's going to be a lot more like you just go like, I don't know, you know, 38, 39 states in this country have liberalized electricity markets. So good luck going and doing like a French style nuclear build out in a liberalized electricity market. And, it, you know, there's a few people who are like, let's go re-regulate or, you know, kind of let's go back to the old vertical utility, whatever.
I mean, but people, I'd love to see more of that. And I do actually think that there is some possibility of using the Tennessee Valley Authority, the existing, yeah, you know, crown jewel.
No, I think,
yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can do that in, like, I'm all for, like, TVA, let's just, like, build a bunch of nuclear. Like, that's just top-down, centralized. Like, that's what TVA was literally created to do. And it still exists, and it could still do it. You know, and frankly, you know, in those minority of U.S. states where there's, you know, still the kind of institutional arrangements, where you can kind of go build a bunch of AP1000s, I'm all for like, go build a bunch of AP1000s. But you know what? You're not going to do that in California. You're not going to do that in Texas. You're not going to do that in, you know, frankly, most electricity markets in the United States. So, you know, that's where I'm kind of like, it's probably going to be much more sort of innovation driven, you know, and new technologies. And that's why I spend so much time banging on the NRC, because I don't think our regulator is remotely set up in a way that like anyone could kind of go do sort of small, innovative, advanced technologies, which I think is what's going to be necessary to make much headway for nuclear in most parts of the United States. And I think you can kind of extend that insight more broadly, which is like, what are, you know, kind of, you go to war or you kind of try to solve the problem, either you're going to solve it with the institutions you have, or you need to go create some new institutions. And so, you know, when I look at like what We Planet is doing, I mean, I my sense is that as We Planet matures, you're going to see quite different strategies, even among We Planet chapters, depending on where they are. That, you know, what We Planet in Bangladesh is going to do is not going to be what We Planet in Germany is going to do.
Let's imagine that I'm on team degrowth, and I'm going to ask you the harder questions. So the charge from that side is that eco-modernism is hopelessly techno-optimistic or focused on techno-fixes. How do you respond to that? Basically, that nothing else in society needs to change, and all that we need to do is come up with these magical technologies that will solve everything.
I mean, I am on one level, I'm a techno-optimist. I just sort of think that sort of technology has made the world vastly better in almost every kind of domain, and it creates new problems, but the new problems are almost always better than the old problems. You know, you'd rather be dealing with obesity than like, you know, having like half your population die in famines every 20 years. Just to take a kind of particularly kind of stark example of it. So, you know, I'm kind of like, I'm not, there's this thing, which of course is very convenient, especially because we kind of have been in the Bay Area, and it's like, you guys are just like these Silicon Valley tech bros, and you're just kind of carrying water for the sort of Musks and Peter Thiels of the world. And, you know, the irony of it is that from the very beginnings, like we've been sort of setting our hair on fire. You know, like I never was able to raise any money out of Silicon Valley. I never was able, you know, never really got a whole lot of kind of pickup there because, yeah, you know, we believe in technology. We think it's sort of the critical fulcrum that kind of actually mediates the human nature relationship, the human environment. You know, when you look at the relationship between sort of human living standards and environmental impacts, technology literally is the kind of fulcrum that determines what the relationship between those things is. And that's not really a controversial idea. I mean, that goes back to like, even like Paul Ehrlich and John, who did the original IPAT, impact equals population times affluence times technology, acknowledged that. It was the T in that equation that determined what impact population growth and affluence had on impacts. Of course, the two of them immediately ignore the technology part and go to sort of the population part, which was terrible. But so this is not a particularly controversial idea. And, you know, the problem with the Silicon Valley guys is that they thought they invented all this stuff. You know, they're like, you know, this all got invented in Bill Hewlett's garage, which was always nonsense. And we were kind of actually the first and loudest people pointing out that like the entire sort of ICT revolution, which is kind of like the kind of, you know, a prototype for the sort of Silicon Valley tech bro of, for everything, is literally like, it's not invented in some like entrepreneur's garage. It's invented by the Department of Defense. And, you know, so it's quite ironic that, you know, I have been accused for so many years of just sort of being the Silicon Valley tech bro, because I've never gotten much of a hearing in Silicon Valley. They're kind of like, yeah, we agree on the technology, now go away and we're going to go solve the problem. And so, I don't think it, I don't think one can actually look at our history and make the claim, but, in this sort of crazy discourse that we all sort of operate in, it's just an easy, lazy, familiar cliche to use to just sort of not deal with the things that we're saying, which is that, like, even if the degrowthers got everything they wanted, they would need a techno fix.
Right.
That's the irony of it. You can't do the math without the techno fix.
So I wanted to ask just one thing, because a little bit ago you just said the words new institutions and also war. And I wonder how you foresee the coming period. I mean, the geopolitical competition. I mean, it's quite evident in the US, less so in Europe, more so in China, etc. And how you see that relating to environmental questions, and particularly to decreasing carbon emissions, whether you think those are things that can go hand in hand?
Yeah, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago, right after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, basically saying, like, this is the end of the post-Cold War sort of globalization era, and that had, like, kind of major implications for climate. And so I observed a couple of things, which is that if you just look at the kind of rate of sort of decarbonization, global decarbonization, it happens actually faster in the sort of pre-globalization period, that's sort of really kind of determined by kind of global competition in the Cold War, geopolitical, than it is in the sort of era, post-Cold War era, where climate becomes kind of one of the major things that, like, kind of arguably kind of globalized trade and then, like, a global framework for dealing with climate change are, like, the two big initiatives of the post-Cold War era. Mm. Obviously we're going to kind of take all the trade barriers down, and we're going to have the coming together.
Convergence.
Yes, convergence is the word I was looking for. And, we're going to get this sort of global cap, and we're going to have this global trade emissions trading system, and we're going to do technology transfer, where the rich are going to help the poor by giving, sort of beneficently giving them their technology, and they're going to pay off their carbon debt by paying for adaptation to climate change. And this is literally the entire international framework for how to deal with climate change kind of literally comes into view literally just as the Cold War is ending, and in a lot of ways sort of replaces sort of trying to avoid a nuclear confrontation in the Cold War, like the big international project for the United Nations and the sort of international community becomes a globalized response to climate change. And if you just look at it, we don't do very well. We don't make much progress, actually. And so, what I argued in that piece, and I think it's kind of proven to be true, is that we're now back to something that looks more like the Cold War era, where you have geopolitical competition sort of driving and driven by energy security considerations, sort of driving much more sort of direct state level and sort of geopolitical block level strategies to invest in energy technology and infrastructure and energy security.
Mm.
It brings with it all sorts of other, this is where we should remember that climate change is not, I don't really think it's an existential risk. But even if you do, it's certainly not the only existential risk that we face. Right. And so there's real trade-offs here. Like, we, in this era of sort of new era of geopolitical competition that we've entered, we may make more progress on climate change, and we could also blow up the world in the process. So, be careful what you wish for.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. I wondered if I could take the opportunity to ask you just a question about a former collaborator, a close collaborator of yours, Michael Schellenberger. I, as I said, live here in São Paulo, Brazil, and I went to check out the kind of right-wing demonstrations that were happening a couple of weeks ago, and they were related to kind of free speech issues, but it was mainly just a regular gathering of the right and the far right. And Michael Schellenberger was on stage there next to former President Jair Bolsonaro. And I was a little bit taken aback because he's someone who I think has done some good stuff on freedom of speech. But, you know, it seems to me has been so alienated by left liberalism that he swung over entirely to the other side. And so anyway, I wonder what your relationship is with him. And I imagine maybe some of our listeners who will be familiar with you and with him are interested in what your relationship is.
Yeah, well, you know, Michael left Breakthrough right after we published the Eco-Modernist Manifesto. And, you know, that was a split that was a long time coming. You know, we sort of obviously shared, you know, we built the Breakthrough Institute together. We really kind of invented eco-modernism with some other partners together. But, you know, I think, you know, Michael was always a partisan in a way that I wasn't. And he started out as a partisan of the left. And, you know, over time, for a variety of, I think, personal and professional, and actually, you know, Michael was a guy who always, you know, the most important thing to him was to have an audience. And I think over the last decade, since he left Breakthrough, he figured out that, you know, the audience he could build was on the right. And so that's where he went. And it's kind of amazing. I don't know what he was saying at that rally, but go back and read the chapter on Brazil in the book Breakthrough, and I'm pretty sure you'll be like, oh my God, how could this possibly be the same guy? Mm-hmm. Because in that book, we're writing about Lula and, you know, like the, you know, quite significant and important progress that was made on, Brazilian deforestation during that era. And we're literally, we're attacking debt for nature swaps and basically being like, no, the debt's illegitimate. You know, it was taken on by, you know, military dictators.
Yeah.
And like, we're like, no, forgive the debt so that Brazil has kind of, you know, the capability, or at least the possibility of sort of developing in a way where they might decide to spare their rainforest.
Right. No, that's interesting. Lee.
Yeah. So this year was the last ever Breakthrough Dialogue, the conference where you host key figures from across the environmental movement, politics, the various environmental sciences, social sciences, and beyond, including some of your fiercest critics. You were always welcoming them to debate you, to achieve disagreement, as you put it. But in recent years, many of those critics started to stop wanting to come. I want to know sort of why you think that was, and also about why this was the last dialogue, and what your next move is beyond eco-modernism. It seems like the next step is you're fitting yourselves into this broader abundance agenda with some other groups and think tanks and modes of thought, like the supply-side liberalism around like Ezra Klein and figures like that. How is this all coming together? What's the next step for this school of thought? Why do you feel that eco-modernism fits so well with this abundance agenda?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, you're right that, you know, one of the reasons that we stopped, you know, we decided that after like 15 years, this was this last summer, 20th anniversary of the death of environmentalism, was going to be the last Breakthrough Dialogue, was that it just got harder and harder to get anyone who disagreed with us to come. And, you know, I don't think that's because we became less welcoming. I just think that, you know, in the environmental discourse, there's this idea that you kind of, the way to make progress is to sort of kind of create this epistemic bubble around whether it's climate risk or, you know, and you kind of kick everybody else out so that like the bubble is kind of, there's no challenge to it within the bubble. And then like, you know, I don't, there's a kind of inchoate theory of change here that doesn't actually make any sense. But I think it just kind of makes people feel good. And And, you know, I'm always happy to go and go into the lion's den and kind of debate or argue anyone who wants to have the argument, whether they're degrowthers or traditional environmentalists or anything else. But I think in the environmental community, there's just no interest in that. It's just like you're either with us or you're a science denier who does not have a right to be in the public square. And so at some point, it's kind of like, I don't know exactly what we're going to do next in terms of like the follow up for that event. But, you know, and the irony is that where I kind of go is like, yeah, okay, well, let's, you know, maybe we're past the point of like, let's go all kind of achieve disagreement and debate. And it's just like, it's just movement building. Like, let's go kind of bring, I mean, I think there are like actually important questions within the eco-modernist tent that I would like more space to kind of work through. And it doesn't mean that we have to come up with an answer that everyone has to agree with. But I'd like to kind of I don't want to be like the environmental movement. I want to have much more sort of transparent and open and respectful debates within our community about like what is the right role of state versus market, you know, in various places, or you know, what is the kind of the right mix of big nuclear versus small nuclear? You know, and how does that fit with the obvious reality that like whether or not you can run the whole planet on it, you know, we're going to have a shit ton of cheap solar and, you know, lots of really interesting questions like that. And how do you deal with, it's fine to be like, everyone needs to stop being a peasant, but you know, there's a couple billion peasants still on the planet and it would be a bad thing just to like kick them off their land. You know, so there's lots of really interesting, exciting questions. And I just want to have those conversations with people who are willing to have the conversation and are open to kind of like, you know, a sort of dialectical ongoing conversation to sort of figure out kind of a good place to be on a bunch of these questions. And then that kind of leads into the abundance thing, which is like, and you know, who I know, you know, Alex Trembath, who's my deputy and longtime kind of partner at Breakthrough in a lot of this work. And, you know, Alex and I, and especially Alex keeps trying to like, with a bunch of the abundance and the sort of pragmatic socialist kind of, he's like, stop pretending or thinking that environmentalists are your friends and your allies. They're not. Like they're your enemy, just to be blunt about it. And so when I look at the abundance movement, you know, and I kind of go like, that's my message to the abundance movement is don't let the kind of environmental blob into the tent. Like you can come in the tent, but you have to stop being an environmentalist because we're going to go build a new world and you're right in the way.
Right.
Nice. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, I like that.
I like that. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on. I don't know if Lee, you wanted to add anything in, at the end.
I think that's really, we covered a lot of stuff there. Yeah. Thanks, Dan.
So yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for doing this dialogue thing that you are interested in doing over here on BungaCast as well. And maybe we can do this again another time.
Yeah, yeah. I would love to do it. And I'm happy to come and argue or do whatever. So thank you for having me. Great.
Fantastic. Great.